clip from your film when Nazi Commandant Rudolf Hess's wife, Hedwig Hensel, speaks to her mother.
Is that the camp wall?
Yes, that's the camp wall. We planted more vines at the back to grow and cover it.
Maybe Esther Silverman is over there.
Which one was she?
The one I used to clean for.
James Wilson, 10 seconds to wrap.
Well, I mean, just to pick up that last point, it was to look for all those details and aspects of our lives in terms of our aspirations, our desire for household comfort, the things that motivated and drove them.
James Wilson, we're going to leave it there. Congratulations on your Oscar nominations for international film at the Oscars, The Zone of Interest. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
I'm Molly, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Portland Water Bureau pushes for an 8% rate increase. The Multnomah County Animal Shelter clarifies its policy on euthanasia. And, in national news, grassroots groups emphasize the significance of the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. I'm Josh Salem. Portland City Councilors will vote this week to approve a potential 8% rate hike by the Portland Water Bureau. The city says this means the average residential water bill will jump from $56 a month up to $60. The change comes as multiple city bureaus are looking to fill budget gaps in the next year. If approved, the 7.9% rate hike would start at the beginning of July. The Portland City Council will hear testimony and vote on increasing the rate hike on Wednesday, and the discussion will begin at 3:30 p.m. Last week, local media outlets discovered that the Multnomah County Animal Shelter updated their euthanasia policy on their website. In it, it removed the language that said that animals would not be euthanized for a lack of shelter space. This prompted significant public outcry against the embattled county animal shelter, which has been the subject of repeated audits. Now they've clarified. The county says, despite the language change they made, their practices are the same. Last year, Multnomah County euthanized 486 dogs and cats in its shelters. Compare that to King County, Washington, more than twice the size of Multnomah County. They euthanized only 350 animals. Julie Sullivan Springetti is with the county press office. She told the Portland Mercury, quote, "We do not euthanize healthy and safe animals for space. We didn't then, we don't now," end quote. The Oregon Senate passed a bill that would end daylight savings time in Oregon, provided Washington and California do the same. It would make standard time year-round, without an hour added in the springtime or dropped in the fall. Daylight savings is the practice of moving the clock forward 1 hour so that in the summertime, nightfall happens later in the day. Hawaii and Arizona are already on permanent standard time. The bill would switch to a similar structure once Washington and California agree, so long as that happens in the next 10 years. The Oregon House still needs to weigh in before the session ends. The short legislative session ends the same day that daylight savings time begins, March 10th. The Supreme Court rules no state can remove a federal candidate from an election ballot, saying that power rests with Congress. Super Tuesday primaries are today in 16 states. And a Colorado court rules in the killing of Elijah McClain in police custody. With those stories and more, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
On January 6th, if Donald Trump wins, I think we can absolutely expect that there will be members of Congress who will object to electoral votes he's won, perhaps in many, many states, on the basis that he's not a qualified candidate.
David Becker with the Center for Election Innovation and Research says the Supreme Court has ruled unanimously that no single state can disqualify former President Trump for his role in the January 6th insurrection. But Becker says the ruling is not an exoneration on the substance, and people in Congress could still challenge Trump's right to take office under the 14th Amendment. Trump posted a rambling speech on Truth Social that thanked the court, but then veered into tangled comments on a separate legal issue now also before the SCOTUS, his claim that a president has unlimited immunity from criminal prosecution.
Nobody that is serving in that office will have the courage to make, in many cases, what would be the right decision, or it could be the wrong decision. It could be, in some cases, the wrong decision, but they have to make decisions, and they have to make them free of all terror that can be rained upon them when they leave office or even before they leave office.
Meanwhile, the former chief financial officer of Trump's real estate company pleaded guilty to two counts of perjury Monday. Today is Super Tuesday. Primaries or caucuses in 16 states. Sylvia Albert with Common Cause says voters need to be aware because state election laws are constantly changing.
Some of them have passed great new laws that expand access to the ballot, like Minnesota and Massachusetts, Colorado. But then you also have states that have passed laws that limit access to the ballot, like North Carolina, that eliminated the 3-day grace period.
Mail-in ballots in North Carolina will no longer count if received within 3 days after the election. Jack Teixeira has accepted 16 years in prison under a plea deal. The Air National Guardsman used top-secret clearance to access classified intelligence so he could impress people in an online chat group. Jason Casey is an assistant United States attorney in Massachusetts.
To put it in context, this airman was the IT guy. He had no business being in areas where super sensitive kinds of intelligence were being disseminated.
A Colorado court has sentenced a paramedic to 5 years for giving Elijah McClain a fatal dose of ketamine. The black pedestrian died after a 2019 confrontation with police. Shanine McClain, Elijah's mother, says it's been hard to wait so long and not see systemic change.
Unfortunately, this is it, right? I don't see no hope. I don't see no change. A little bit of law here, a little bit of law there. Nothing stops their hatred. Nothing stops their racism. And nothing stops their evil protocols.
I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Advocates for voting rights are reflecting on the significance of the upcoming hearing for the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Grassroots groups emphasize they face challenges in engaging communities amidst changing voting laws. This crucial legislation aims to combat discrimination and ensure equal access to the ballot box. Shantaya Hudson reports.
As the hearing for the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act approaches, advocacy groups are reflecting on its importance. For the nonprofit group Sawiga Rising, which focuses on grassroots issues such as civil rights and rural growth, there have been significant changes in how they can engage the community in voting. Sherelle Bird is the group's executive director. She says they have had to shift their efforts away from strategies that help secure funding and engage voters in line.
It is now a felony in the state of Georgia for any organization or individual to provide water and snacks and aid to people who are standing in line. And we've also seen changes as it relates to absentee ballots and how people can turn in their absentee ballots.
Bird argues that laws such as these continuously create barriers to accessing the polls. The John Lewis Act would enhance the government's ability to address voting discrimination and ensure equal access to the ballot box. Bird emphasizes the significance of this issue, highlighting the wide variations in voting laws across different states. According to the 2023 Brennan Center for Justice Voting Laws Roundup, 14 states enacted restrictive voting laws, while others sought to enhance voting accessibility.
It's important for America to have just a baseline that this is, at the very least, what the minimum access should look like across the board, so that every American that has the right to vote can have easy and safe access to the polls.
She highlights the obstacles have hindered individuals of color, those with disabilities, and rural dwellers, emphasizing the pressing need for sharing their respective experiences.
I think what's important that people don't understand is the power of their story and of their narrative, and what you're dealing with in your state matters. And so contact your legislators, contact your senators, let them know your challenges that you may be experiencing at the polls, so that they can be armed with that information when they have their Senate hearing.
Named after the civil rights leader and Georgia Congressman John Lewis, the bill was reintroduced by Democratic Senators Raphael Warnock of Georgia and Dick Durbin of Illinois. The Senate Judiciary Committee will hold a hearing on the John Lewis Act on March 12th. For Georgia News Connection, I'm Shantia Hudson. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
A new film highlights clean energy opportunities available to rural electric cooperatives from the $11 billion 2022 Inflation Reduction Act. The U.S. Department of Agriculture began accepting applications last September for grants and loans from the Empowering Rural America program, also known as New ERA. Roz Brown has more in San Antonio.
A film debuts in Texas today to help member-owned utility customers learn more about opportunities coming their way from the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act. Power to the People, the story of rural electric cooperatives, is a short animated feature highlighting what could be transformative for many rural communities. Philip Frasica with Renew Missouri says money from the New Era Clean Energy Program will reduce costs for rural Americans while improving grid reliability. To be eligible, he notes applicants had to document how a community would benefit.
To get access to financing and forgivable funding for clean energy projects, so we're wanting to help them with that part of this process to really help streamline it and make sure that community interests are being valued and considered.
Cooperatives are consumer-owned utilities that purchase electric power at wholesale and deliver it directly to the customer. As nonprofits, they often lack capital to add clean energy resources to their grid, such as wind and solar. The film, created by the Rural Power Coalition, debuts at the Power Exchange Conference in San Antonio. Bree Nisley with the environmental group Appalachian Voices says co-op serves some 40 million people in more than 90% of federally recognized persistent poverty counties.
Co-ops provide electricity to some of the most disadvantaged communities in the country, low-income communities in Appalachia, black and brown communities in the Black Belt, the borderlands, tribal lands.
The USDA said it received record demand for the New Era funding, which it views as a generational opportunity using clean energy to cut consumer costs in low-income communities across the country. Currently, two-thirds of rural electricity comes from fossil fuels. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News in Depth. At 6, it's Trans-Positive PDX. Then at 7, Eco-Justice Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 35. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 48. Today in history, in 1770, five Americans, including Crispus Attucks, are fatally shot in the Boston Massacre, an event that would contribute to the outbreak of the American Revolutionary War 5 years later. The quote of the day is from theorist and economist Rosa Luxemburg, who said, "Without general elections, without unrestricted freedom of press and assembly, without a free struggle of opinion, life dies out in every public institution, becomes a mere semblance of life, in which only the bureaucracy remains as the active element. Public life gradually falls asleep. A few dozen party leaders of inexhaustible energy in boundless experience direct and rule." Native Public Media is petitioning the FCC to create a missing and endangered adults alert code, similar to the Amber Alert. They say it's a critical step in addressing the missing and murdered indigenous people crisis. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. a national center for Native radio and TV broadcasters, is leading an effort to establish an alert code for missing and endangered adults. The Mountain West News Bureau's Caleb Radel has more.
In 2022, more than 10,000 Indigenous people were reported missing to the FBI. That's a higher rate of disappearance than the general population. That's why Native Public Media is petitioning the FCC to create the Missing and Endangered Persons Event Code, similar to what the Amber Alert is for missing children. Loris Taylor is the CEO of Native Public Media and a member of Arizona's Hopi Nation.
Native Americans face a crisis. We're three times more likely to experience violent crime. And there's been a wave of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls for a very long time.
She says a dedicated national alert would help law enforcement and communities locate these individuals. On March 14th, the FCC will discuss the proposed alert code. If approved, a public comment period on its proposed rules would follow. I'm Caleb Radel.
In California, a notification system for Native people marked its one-year implementation in January. The Feather Alert is used to notify the public and law enforcement about missing Native Americans. Tribal leaders, law enforcement, and California state lawmakers are reviewing the program for more effective use. Assemblymember James Ramos authored legislation creating the alert. He says it's a great tool. Ramos says in its first year, the notification system had some positive results, but he says it needs some tweaks.
The Feather Alert follows the Amber Alert here in the state of California. And one of the complexities of it is now you include tribal governments into the component. So we created the law. It's the first year that it went through. We understand that there was five different times that it was requested to be implemented. Three of those were denied. Two of them were implemented. Those two that were implemented, those individuals were found and brought back home safely.
There are questions over why the other three were not implemented being raised with the California Highway Patrol, which administers the system.
Working with the CHP, the California Highway Patrol, who's open, the Commissioner Duray, is open to criticism, open to make it a finer piece of arsenal for those to bring back the missing.
A bill to make changes to the Feather Alert with input from tribes and law enforcement is included in a package of bills Ramos recently announced for 2024.
And it's unique because there's a lot of bills that pass in the California state legislature that never get brought back up to fine tune them. Again, Indian people are leading the way. After a year, we're already bringing this bill back up to fine tune it. I think we're leading the way of how some other bills could be fine-tuned that affect California's people.
Ramos says part of the challenge with the Feather Alert is making the general public aware of it and bridging communication gaps among law enforcement and tribes. The issue of missing and murdered Indigenous people has been a priority of Ramos since his election in 2018, becoming the first California Native American to serve in the state legislature. This story is a collaboration with First Nations Experience Television with support from the Public Welfare Foundation. The virtual panel Accelerating Empowerment of Indigenous Women and Girls is planned for March 12 to address violence against Indigenous women in the Americas. It will feature speakers from Brazil, Guatemala, Peru, and the U.S. The event's part of a forum during a session of the U.N. Commission on the Status of Women. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Oregonians will soon have the right to repair their electronics thanks to a bill passed in the state legislature. That's, of course, if Governor Tina Kotek signs the bill, which was passed by the Oregon House on Monday. It's the strongest such bill in the nation, making it easier for individuals and repair shops to fix smartphones, computers, and other electronics. Manufacturers are increasingly locking away parts of the repair process or requiring consumers to use authorized repair shops and parts only. The bill requires electronics manufacturers to make parts, tools, manuals, and documentation available to the public so they can be fixed. Oregon's law is also the first to address parts pairing, which refers to when a repair must use a licensed or proprietary device in order to complete the repair. It bans that practice starting January of next year, and it's not so coincidentally why Apple opposed the bill. Analysis by Osberg, a nonpartisan public interest group, showed that being able to fix phones, computers, and appliances instead of having to buy new ones could save the average Oregonian household some $380 per year. The right to repair is also on the books in California, Colorado, Minnesota, and New York, but Oregon's is the widest ranging so far. Republican Arizona legislators are pushing a number of bills that some are calling anti-immigration. Opponents consider such measures a step in the wrong direction. Alex Gonzalez has the details.
The Republican-controlled Arizona legislature has passed a number of bills that some immigration advocates are calling SB 1070 2.0. Senate Bill 1231, otherwise known as the Arizona Invasion Act, would give law enforcement the authority to arrest migrants who are crossing the border and don't have the appropriate documentation. Republican lawmakers argue the law would help control migrant numbers in the Grand Canyon state. The Tucson sector had the most migrant encounters of any sector along the U.S.-Mexico border, with more than 250,000 in the first 4 months of fiscal year 2024, according to Customs and Border Protection data. But Representative Annalise Ortiz says the bill will lead to racial profiling.
It is not the state's place to enforce federal immigration law. And when we do that, we subject entire communities to terror, to racial profiling, and to harassment.
While the measure may face opposition from Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs, she may not be able to intercept other Republican-backed immigration proposals. If approved, voters in November could enact House Concurrent Resolution 2060 that would expand verification regulations for businesses to check the status of independent subcontractors and make it harder for migrants to access public benefits. Representative Lorena Austin of Phoenix says SB 1231 has what they call unintended and intended consequences, and adds that Arizona is still trying to cope with the impacts of SB 1070, a controversial 2010 immigration law that some contend led to widespread racial profiling in Arizona.
We saw that over 10 years ago when thousands of people were being illegally stopped and targeted, and that shame is still something that clouds this state.
Arizona Republicans argue that the federal government has failed to secure the southern border, leading to an uncontrollable flow of migrants who have not followed proper protocol to immigrate, which is causing issues for those who are trying to do so legally. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
After the U.S. Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade, accessible and affordable reproductive health care has become even more important in Mississippi. Despite abortion being banned in the state, a Jackson organization reports a rise in women seeking help to get abortions, and they offer financial assistance and transportation to help people travel out of state for the procedure. Danielle Smith tells us more.
Amid ongoing concerns about reproductive access in the Magnolia State, a Jackson-based organization is offering financial help and other support services to women seeking abortions and other resources. More than 23 million women in the U.S. live in states with abortion restrictions, raising concerns about reproductive rights. Lori Bertram Roberts with Mississippi Reproductive Freedom Fund says they assist Mississippi women to travel out of state to either Illinois, New York, or Orlando, Florida, to access abortion care since it is illegal in Mississippi.
So we can help them with travel costs or with helping pay for their procedure. We can give them a mobile abortion doula, a support person, you know, that they can have by phone through the process. Just letting folks know that they still can have an abortion outside of Mississippi.
She says they are no longer able to provide monthly birth control pills because of a lack of funding. In the meantime, the Mississippi House passed House Bill 1725. It would provide access to health care via a Medicaid expansion bill for pregnant mothers that are facing a financial hardship. The bill now awaits a vote by the state Senate and approval by Governor Tate Reeves. Bertram Roberts says the demographics of women requiring their organization's assistance with reproductive health has grown and changed as a result of the Mississippi abortion ban. She adds that they have also had an increase and women needing access to emergency contraception.
I feel like a lot of people didn't understand how the morning after pill works for a long time, but now because people are hyper aware of not wanting to be pregnant, our demand on how, you know, people picking up Plan B has really picked up. We give away about 8,000 units a year if we have them in stock.
Bertram Roberts points out that they also provide women with diapers, menstrual cycle products, food from their pantry, library resources, condoms, and pregnancy tests. Mississippi legislators in the state house have proposed 8 bills this year to either tighten abortion laws or repeal abortion restrictions. I'm Danielle Smith, Mississippi News Connection.
Israel is dependent on U.S. military aid for its Gaza operations, yet the Biden administration is unwilling to use that dependence as leverage to demand more humanitarian assistance for Gaza's devastated population. One commentator says, until it is willing, food and water will fall far short of what is needed to save lives. Now we go to Global Citizen Commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. Progressive senators have been pressing the Biden administration on two fronts in the Gaza war, expanding humanitarian aid to Palestinians and conditioning non-defensive military aid to Israel. What we have here are two sides of the same coin. You cannot safely deliver humanitarian assistance without a ceasefire and a halt to Israel's military operations, which use U.S. bombs and artillery shells. I reported a few weeks ago that Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, joined by our Senator Jeff Merkley and 17 other senators, sought to amend an emergency national security bill that contained $14 billion in additional military aid to Israel. Van Hollen's amendment did not put stringent limits on the aid. It merely proposed that the State Department report on whether or not U.S. aid was being used in conformity with U.S. and international humanitarian laws. The amendment was not allowed up for a vote, but some of its language found its way into National Security Memorandum 20, which stands as official U.S. policy on weapons transfers. NSM 20 is a slight improvement on long-standing U.S. policy concerning the provision of military aid to human rights abusers. It requires that use of U.S. arms in violation of U.S. and international law be investigated and reported, with the possibility that violations will result in a pause or even termination of the aid. Whether or not the Biden administration will implement that policy to stop Prime Minister Netanyahu from seeking total victory is debatable. Up to now, the basic situation is this. The U.S. keeps shipping non-defensive weapons that Israel's army keeps using against civilian targets. This situation should not require more investigating and reporting, nor should it require further consultation with Israel's government to request adherence to humanitarian law and values. What is required is a U.S. decision to stop arming Israel with non-defensive weapons unless and until it adheres to U.S. and international law in its fight with Hamas. As Fareed Zakaria writes in a recent Washington Post editorial, quote, the image of U.S. officials wringing their hands about civilian casualties while providing ever more weapons is grotesque. Senator Merkley put the matter correctly in a statement of February 16, in which he explained why he had voted against the emergency funding bill. Merkley's statement underscored two points. First, that U.S. weapons are being used against civilians in Gaza, contrary to international and humanitarian law and American values. And second, that Prime Minister Netanyahu has rejected every attempt by President Biden to restrain the use of force there and dramatically increase humanitarian aid to Gaza's civilians. The issue of arms to Israel raises the larger question of how to monitor and act on an ally's use of U.S. weapons for purposes other than self-defense. It is one thing for Israel to use U.S. weapons to go after Hamas following the October 7 attack, and quite another to engage in indiscriminate bombing of civilian targets that have resulted in what the UN and other observers call a humanitarian catastrophe. In that situation, the burden of proof should be on the arms recipient, Israel, either to restrain the behavior of its military forces or explain why it is using U.S. arms in ways that clearly will cause large civilian casualties and damage to civilian structures, such as hospitals and schools. When, as in the present instance, Israel is unwilling to restrain its military operations or provide a morally or legally acceptable explanation for the civilian losses, when in fact the Netanyahu government has shown consistent disregard for U.S. appeals, the U.S. government has the obligation not just to impose conditions on its aid, but to deny aid altogether. The moral dimension of the issue is no less important than the politics. As Senator Merkley's statement indicates, the Palestinian people are not the enemy, yet they have paid the highest price in this war. Over 30,000 dead, two-thirds of them women and children. Countless others have been injured, their livelihood shattered, their health care and educational systems destroyed. The deaths, most recently of 100 Gazans during food distribution, only underscores the desperate conditions there. Israel's principal justification for its military actions is national security. Yet while those actions will probably reduce the threat posed by Hamas in the immediate future, the argument is short-sighted. Hamas, or any organization that replaces or aligns with it, will have no trouble recruiting in the face of Israel's destruction of Gaza. Hezbollah and other hostile groups in the Middle East will be emboldened to engage in terrorist acts against Israel. Israel's Arab neighbors, starting with Saudi Arabia, will reject normalization of relations. Israel will lose valuable political support in Europe, the UN, and elsewhere. The accusation heard more and more that Israel is engaging in genocide and colonialism will resonate with many people who ordinarily are Israel's friend. Lastly, this war will profoundly affect Israeli democracy, further dividing the country and inviting government decisions that undermine human rights and the rule of law. In short, Israel's war on Hamas is increasing the country's insecurity just as surely as it is increasing human insecurity for Palestinians. I'm Mel Gertoff of the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 5th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff, David Rosenberg, and Birdie. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Roz Brown, Danielle Smith, Shantaya Hudson, Farah Siddiqui, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.